This is Nightmare in Wisconsin.
The trial of Taylor Shabusiness. Accusations of first-degree intentional homicide, strangulation, mutilation, dismemberment, and necrophilia.
We bring you raw, unfiltered courtroom audio from the trial of Taylor Shabusiness. Nightmare in Wisconsin.
And ladies and gentlemen, in the event you were wondering, you are going to get a copy of these instructions during your deliberations, because I know they're lengthy. Having said that, Mr. Saunders, are you prepared to give a closing argument?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very good. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. I want to start with something that we heard yesterday, or actually Monday, during opening statements. Counsel told us that, you know, there's always two sides to every story. And with all due respect, this is not one of those stories. This is a story that pretty clearly shows what happened. It's a story of the defendant taking a dog collar that was around her friend's neck and pulling it so hard and for so long and with such force that it caused his death. That in that moment, she made a deliberate choice to end her friend's life. She then, after the fact, degrades his body, engages in sexual acts with him. This is a story of the defendant then dismembering him and leaving his remains all over the house for his mother to find. And this isn't the state's story. This isn't law enforcement's story. It's the defendant's story, as you heard today, right? So as we go through this, it's easy to sit here and say, yes, the defendant confessed, and it's true. She confessed to every single element that you will see that the state needs to prove. But we didn't just stop there, right? We could have been done with this case on Monday, played her interview and called it a day. But you should expect more, right? We have the burden of proof, and obviously we called a number of witnesses to establish what this story shows. So I want to walk through that story. And I know there's a lot of law that was just read to you. But I'm a visual learner, so I like to see kind of what we're looking at here. So as I go through these three offenses, there's really, as you'll see, six things the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Not every fact that was testified to, not what time somebody got to Scott Holmes' house at the end of the night. The six elements are what the state needs to prove to you beyond a reasonable doubt, okay? So first, count one, first-degree intentional homicide. First, that the defendant caused the death of Shad and that she, second, acted with intent to kill him, okay? And again, as I already mentioned, as we go through these elements, you heard earlier this morning that the defendant is acknowledging every element that we hear, okay? Independent of the information you heard today, with the investigation you heard, the DNA, the other information, Dr. Tranquita's testimony, I would argue, would prove all these elements as well. But you have on top of that the defendant's admissions to all these elements. Okay, so the defendant caused the death of Shad. I mean, that should be fairly clear here. Obviously, she admits that. You heard Dr. Tranquita's testimony of how Shad died, the cause and the manner of death, strangulation, excessive force being placed on the neck, producing his death. That was the sole cause of death that we heard. So let's talk about intent, right? Because that admittedly sometimes is a tricky topic, right? We can never know anyone's intent truly. And as you're told, you're not going into the mind of somebody, right? Kind of looking at all the facts and circumstances that you see. In this case, you have the benefit of the defendant opening up her mind to you and telling you what her intent was here. But you also have other signs, right? So what does intent mean? That somebody had the mental purpose to do something, right? Some volition. Or that they're aware that what they're doing is practically certain to cause that result, right? And you heard both, really, from the defendant. So I want to walk through that because there's a lot of points in that interview where the defendant is telling you exactly what her intent was in this case, right? His face was turning purple, right? She describes that and how he's coughing up blood. And you know that's accurate, right? Because you heard Dr. Tranquita's testimony and you saw those photographs. She's seeing that in person, and yet what does she say? I still didn't stop. No, she felt a heartbeat at one point, right? She talks about feeling his heartbeat, and she kept pulling more, and he wouldn't die. And, you know, I just wanted him, and I was like, damn. Right? She admits even that Shad's struggling in this moment, that he's fighting back, right? You heard from Dr. Shankita as well about how it looked like at one point there were signs of that, where the collar slipped up along the tongue. She's telling you, I was waiting for him to die. I liked it. She figured I'm already this far, and she's pantomiming the act. It's like she's starting a lawnmower. That's how hard she's pulling on this chain, right? Took 3 to 5 minutes, she thinks. And again, that's consistent with Dr. Tranquita, right? This is not an accident. This isn't a whoops. This is an intentional act, right? We don't need to prove that she went to that house with this intent, right? We talked about that in voir dire, and we kind of talked through that concept of how, as you're instructed, intent can be formed in the instant before an act, the instant before the pull of a trigger, the instant in this case, before Mission Business decides, I'm gonna go further and pull on this chain so hard that it causes the result that we saw in Shad, right? So we have the mental purpose, right, from the defendant's own mouth, and that's consistent with everything else we're seeing in the case. But you also have Detective Kempf asking her, you know, I mean, in that moment, did you kind of realize if you kept pulling on that chain that he would die? She's like, probably, yeah. Yeah, she was aware of that. All right, so that goes to this kind of the second either-or part of intent, right? Was aware that her conduct was practically certain to cause that result, and it's probably obvious as you sit here of what's going to happen when you're pulling a metal chain like that hard for that long, seeing the result of what's happening to another person, that is going to be the result, right? So you're told you can't look into a person's mind. The defendant told you exactly what her intent was in this case. As I mentioned, you also have other indicators, right? You have Dr. Tranquita's testimony describing the amount of force that would need to have been done to cause the injuries that he's observing, right? Down to the inner neck muscles, and he was talking about how strong and thick those neck muscles are, and there was hemorrhaging that deep. That's how hard and how long and how much injury the defendant was causing, right? This isn't an accident. If it's an accident, you're not going forward. You're not seeing this result and keep pulling. You're calling for help. You're stopping. You're certainly not after the fact, after you finally finish, then cutting up his body, right? You have all the evidence in this case points to intent, right? You have her acts after the fact, like I said. You know, if this was an accident, something happens, right? You call for help, and you have the exact opposite. You have the defendant cutting him up and cleaning up, getting rid of the remains, pouring it down the shower. We heard a lot of testimony about that, kind of wiping up with the Clorox wipes, which the defendant is acknowledging as well. So you have the defendant's statement in the case, and it lines up with everything else in the case, right? Even little facts that she's remembering and telling you about, right? The timeline of the February 21st night, right? We heard from AJ Gannon. You heard the stipulated testimony from Mr. Tomes. You heard from Mike Therian. It's all consistent. Yeah, they were coming and going. You then heard from Steve Hendricks about, yep, they got back sometime in the early morning and I let them in. Defendant's telling you that same thing. Steve is talking about how at one point during the day on the 22nd, she comes up and asks for her eyeglasses, and we heard the defendant talk about that as well. We heard Detective Graff testify about that. So everything she's saying is consistent with what we're objectively seeing, what law enforcement is finding. And in some respects, the defendant's leading the investigation, right? Because when they get there, when law enforcement gets there, we saw Officer Wanish's body cam. We heard from Detective Scanlon and even Dr. Tranquita about how it was really hard to determine what exactly happened when they first got there. And all that information is being provided by the defendant. Okay. So it's an intentional act. She had the mental purpose. We heard about that. It's not, as I talked about, it can be formed at any time before the act, right? It doesn't need to be premeditated. That's not the law in this state. And it's really important to not confuse this with motive, right? We heard evidence about motive, right, and our interest in Jeffrey Dahmer and all that entails. But intent doesn't mean motive. This is what intent means, and we proved intent, right? She caused his death, and she acted intentionally, and she told you as much. So those are the two elements. Those are the two things the state needs to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Count two, mutilating a corpse. So again, there's two elements for this crime. First, the defendant dismembered a corpse. Second, did so with the intent to conceal a crime. So the first element, I think, is pretty clear, right? And we heard extensive testimony from many people, and we saw Dr. Tranquita's diagrams, and obviously I can't imagine this element is going to be in dispute, right? And so again, though, we have this concept of intent, the purpose to conceal a crime, right? And I mean, as you're instructed, you use your common sense. Like, why is somebody going to this length, not only cutting up a body? We heard from Dr. Tranquita about the multiple sort of start and stop kind of signs, the total evisceration of Shad, bagging him into other bags and attempting to carry out. Like, that's the intent, right? We use our common sense that's why you're doing that. But again, she was asked about this, the defendant. And remember in that February 28th interview, the second interview with Detective Groff and Detective Scanlon, she's saying exactly what her intent was, right? It was because there's other people in the house. Like, what am I going to do? Leave the body and have mom find it? She admits, again, this was her intent, and it's obvious with our common sense, but it shows that the state has proved both elements of this crime as well. Okay, count three. It's third-degree sexual assault. So the defendant had sexual intercourse with Shad and did so without consent. So let's talk about the first part. Sexual intercourse is defined in the state as inserting any object into the genital or anal opening of another, or engaging in oral contact with the penis. We heard about both, right? The defendant admitted to both. She's talking about how she's put the dildo in Chad's anus after she killed him. She's talking about how she was sucking on his penis, and there were other phrases used to that effect. So again, we have, for both elements here, the defendant's admissions. And we heard from Mr. Scott, didn't we? We heard from Mr. Scott about the DNA testing that was done, right? And for some of the reasons why, you know, even though the defendant's DNA is on that dildo in Shad's house, Shad's DNA wasn't found on there. And nothing excludes that possibility. And again, everything the defendant's telling you is consistent with other things you're seeing. So there's no reason to believe, a reasonable hypothesis to believe, that she's not also telling you what's happened in this case too, right, for this count. And the second element, did not consent. I mean, that, as you're instructed, is kind of inferred by the fact that at the time that the defendant's telling you she's engaging in these acts, that Chad's deceased, right? So he's not in a position to consent, okay? So those are the two elements for count three. So in total, six elements for the three offenses. And again, you're given a lot of law on how to assess credibility of witnesses, and that's good, and you should follow it. Really, you kind of just use your common sense as jurors. And again, the defendant's telling you what happened, and there's nothing in the case to disbelieve what she's saying, right? So you have the defendant's admissions, as I mentioned earlier. There's other evidence that kind of just only should bolster the conviction in the defendant's guilt, right? We heard from Kevin Scott, who heard or testified about the DNA testing he did. Shad's blood on the defendant's hands, on her clothing, on the sweatpants, about how the knives that were found had Shad's blood on them, right? Even absent her confession, I mean, there's ample evidence here to convict on all three counts. You have many witnesses coming in to talk about the integrity of the investigation, how law enforcement didn't just take the confession and go home, right? We do more, right? Send things in for DNA. We speak with other witnesses. We corroborate the defendant's timeline of things. You heard all that. And that's really important, right? We have the burden of proof. And we talked about that, and we embrace that burden of proof. You should hold us to that standard as the state to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's why we call people from Madison to come up to talk for 5 minutes about, yeah, I received this piece of evidence, and it was fine. And I returned that piece of evidence, and it was fine. Right, because it's important. We want to show that law enforcement did a thorough investigation in this case. And they did. Because we have the burden of proof. You're instructed on what the burden of proof is and what it's not, right? It's a reasonable doubt, a reasonable hypothesis consistent with guilt, or sorry, consistent with innocence, you should find the defendant not guilty. But you're not searching for doubt. You're ultimately searching for the truth. So even if it's a heavy burden, it doesn't mean the decision is difficult in cases. You are instructed not to search for doubt, you're to search for the truth. And there's not a reasonable hypothesis in this case consistent with the defendant's innocence. There just isn't, right? There's one truth in this case. There's one side of the story, and it happens to be the defendant's story as well, but it's consistent with everyone else's story. It's because that story is the truth of what the defendant did to her friend Shad. And based on that, we would ask that you return guilty verdicts on all three counts. Thank you.
Mr. Freelich, are you ready to make your closing argument?
Yes, I am, Your Honor. Thank you. Your Honor, may it please the court, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, Mr. Lesay and Mr. Saunders. Well, as the attorney for the defendant, Taylor Denise Shabizis, I'd like to share with you that I believe this case is a puzzling, unclear, confusing, and bizarre set of facts. It is unknown what really happened between February 22nd of 2022 and February 23rd of 2022. What we do know in this case is that numerous law enforcement officers testified. We had detectives, we had police officers, we had Dr. Trunkita, and DNA experts, forensic specialists, lots of different people, some citizen witnesses. I'd ask that you consider setting aside your emotions and decide this case based on the facts that have been presented. You've sat here for the last 3 days. You've been here in court. I know that you've listened very closely, but don't assume anything. When you deliberate about all of the facts. What we do know is that law enforcement officers on February 23rd of 2022 went to 829 Stony Brook Lane in Green Bay, this small Cape Cod home, and made contact with the occupants, Tara Pakinich, Stephen Hendricks, and Ava Wheelock was woken up, but they were all sitting at the kitchen table, and officers came in to see what was going on. There was a concern, obviously, that there was a bucket down at the end of the stairs. And you heard from Detective Groff that this was an ongoing investigation, law enforcement. They were trying to piece this together. It was an unusual situation. So they were trying to find out what happened. Unfortunately, I believe it was Officer Plonky and Officer Wanish, you know, they testified, they came here and indicated that they went down to check out what was in the basement, and there was the head of Shad Therian in that black Fleet Farm bucket. And the investigation continued on, But what I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, is that there really are no eyewitnesses as to what really happened down in the basement. There is no Taylor Shabizis there, no other people there. And so that'll be something that you'll have to consider and think about. Then law enforcement realized that there was a secondary scene, and that was at 2353 Eastman Avenue, apartment one in that parking lot. And you saw the video. The officers, I think it was Officer Garth Russell, and a couple of other ones, lady who walked up. The officers walked up and they parked a distance away, and they walked up in the snow and they saw a line of cars in front of the apartment complex. And they saw that, they saw a minivan. It was a gold Town and Country Chrysler minivan, and that was a vehicle of concern. Had some snow on the back windshield. There were vehicles on either side. And the officers walked up and they heard or they saw some lights on the van, and then they saw someone come out the front door, and it was my client. It was Taylor Shabizis. At that point, she was arrested by Officer Russell, and another officer then realized there was a male inside of the apartment number one down the hall. Ended up being Scott Tomes, and he was told to lay on the ground and held at gunpoint, and then he was arrested. So two people were taken from the apartment building and taken down to the police station. There was a search of the Eastman Avenue apartment. We don't have any body parts there. I would submit that there really wasn't anything of evidentiary value there. And that was that. Later on, officers and detectives realized that minivan was something that they were concerned about, so that was taken down to the police storage garage. And then we found out that from Dr. Tronchita and some of the other forensic specialists, Andre, I believe it was Investigator Andre, and Zarnacki. And so they donned Tyvek gear, protective PPE equipment, and they methodically investigated the back of the minivan, and they found the crock pot box that was in a laundry basket sitting on a seat, and there were human remains in there. Nobody saw Taylor Shabizis driving this minivan. These are some of the facts that you got to think about. Don't rush to judgment, but talk about it. Analyze it. As jurors, you have to analyze the facts that you hear, and you have to apply the law that the judge gives you. It's a daunting task. So then we hear, you saw the video, the interview between Detective Groff and my client, Taylor Shabizis. She was taken down to the Green Bay Police Department. Photographs were taken of her, and clothes were taken. And she was put in a yellow suit and then later a blue suit, but she was asked questions. And you got to remember what she said and what questions were being asked. She did say during the interview, "I can't think right now. I'm effing nuts." She said that she was up all night, that the body would rebuild itself. She said weird, odd things. Consider her credibility. Consider what she says. Consider what she said to Detective Groff or Detective Scanlon. She said stuff. I would submit that she said things that didn't make sense. She says, "I have no idea," to some of the questions that the detectives asked her. You remember seeing the video on the screen. I'd ask that you recall that she had inappropriate laughs, inappropriate smiling, odd responses.
I would submit that she indicated that she did not have sex. She did not have penis-to-vagina intercourse with Shad Therian. She indicated that she came to the residence and they went downstairs, and within 5 minutes they got to it, whatever that means. She talked about, during the interview with Detective Graff, rebuilding muscle or rebuilding into muscle. Sometimes she wasn't responsive. She talked about hearing gunshots. But I believe Detective Graff said that there were no gunshots in the area of Stony Brook, Eastman Avenue, or some other place. She said she was paranoid. She said weird things like, I don't like open spaces. I don't like open spaces. No clothes came off. No kissing. She said that she allegedly put the dildo into Mr. Therian's backside, his butt area, his anal area. There's no DNA. We heard from Kevin Scott, DNA expert. He must have done real well in school, in chemistry and all that. But the swab from the dildo, item J1, it says the possible contribution of DNA from Shad Therian is inconclusive due to the complexity of the mixture. So I would argue that his DNA is not on the dildo. So I would argue that even though the state is charging out third-degree sexual assault, there is no shred of evidence to support that particular charge. And I'd ask that you take that into account. No evidence at the Eastman Avenue apartment. When Detective Graff had my client come down to the Green Bay Police Department with Detective Kevin Kempf, they were talking with her for a while. The interview was maybe 3 hours or so. And then they took a break because Ms. Shabizis had cuts on her thumb, scratches on her palms, other cuts on her fingers. Some of them were deep. You saw the pictures because I believe they were published. And she was taken over to St. Vincent's Hospital for medical evaluation. I would submit that the blood on her hands may have been her own because of the deep cuts that she had suffered that she had. The defense had subpoenaed Mr. Scott Tomes. He was unavailable, and he gave an account of that night. And he had indicated, at least on Monday night, that would have been February 21st, that Taylor Shabizis and her friend Shad came over. He had seen Shad before, but didn't know his name. And then he thought that they hooked up to do meth. And then he talked about his vehicle. And he talked about that Taylor Shabizis had used his vehicle in the past and didn't get permission on that particular night. Then he indicated that he was drinking. And then he indicated that Taylor Shabizis returned to his house around midnight with his vehicle, went to her bedroom, and he had a suspicion that she may have been high on drugs. And then he had indicated that Taylor had the bedroom and that he would sleep in his chair. So that's, you know, something else that you have to think about. We heard from Lieutenant Buckman. He was a veteran on the Green Bay Police Department, and that he was doing some investigating, and he wasn't sure if Taylor Shabizis was a suspect or a victim because it was an ongoing new investigation. So that's something you have to take into account as well. The state brought up some photographs, a picture of Taylor with her phone, and young girls, I submit, would they like their phones? So do all kids, young people. They like their phones, and they look up things on the internet for a variety of different reasons: shock value, curiosity. But we have a situation here where Taylor did do some searches about Jeffrey Dahmer. I would submit that that's a ruse, that doesn't necessarily mean anything, and that people search the internet for all kinds of things on the internet, and that it's for shock value. So that shouldn't really play any part in this case. I would ask that you discount that and set that aside. Now, I would argue that I would argue that it's not a clear case here. Was this an accidental death? Did Taylor Shabizus kill Shad Therian? Was there intent to kill Shad Therian? Did Taylor Shabizus have the mental purpose to kill Shad Therian? Different theories, different things for you to think about. You are all like analysts, and you have to assess and decipher the facts. The facts here are very complicated, confusing, unclear. Two different locations. No eyewitnesses. Taylor Shabizus, we learned that she went to school with Shad Therian, middle school, Bayport High School. They were friends. They hung out. You heard from A.J. Gannon. He hung out with them as well. Can you trust what someone says when they're hopped up on meth, on drugs? The state wants you to look into Taylor Shabizus' mind to find out what her intent was. And that's a difficult task. Did she have a clear mind on February 22nd of 2022 as to what was really going on? Accidents can happen. When accidents happen, people can make other choices in a panic. Something for you to think about. This sexual assault charge, you know, how can you have sexual intercourse with the facts that have been laid out and presented to you? It's mind-boggling. How can you have sex when genitals are in one place and body's in a different place? It's foggy. It's cloudy. It's hard to imagine, almost impossible to try and figure out what did or didn't happen. I would submit to you that no sexual assault occurred. I'd ask that you find her not guilty of third-degree sexual assault. You can't rely on everything Taylor Shabizus says. Think about that, please. She chose not to testify under our Constitution of the United States of America. She doesn't have to testify. That's what the law provides. You don't have to take the witness stand. You have a right to remain silent. And you can't use that fact alone against her. I would argue that based on all of the evidence and the testimony in this case, that you find my client not guilty of all the charges. Thank you very much for your time.
This case is puzzling. This case is bizarre. This case is in absolutely no way unclear. It is crystal clear what happened to Shad Therian, and we know that. We know that because the defendant told you. She told you what she did to Shad Therian. Is it bizarre? Is it unnatural? Is it strange? Yes, absolutely. People do bizarre, unnatural, strange things. They engage in criminal conduct. People kill other people and they dismember them. That's what Taylor Shabusiness did. And we know exactly what she did because the words from her mouth told you with specificity what she did. Can we trust always what Taylor Shabusiness says? No, but as Mr. Saunders told you, we trust, but we verify. We didn't stop at taking her statement. We corroborated. She guided the investigation with the specificity of her statement. How can we not trust her statement when she describes in detail the mechanism of injury, which is exactly what is described and confirmed by Dr. Tranchida? Excessive strangulation over a period of time with layers of injury, exactly as she described it. Described that his tongue would be out. She described that. Dr. Tranchida described that and showed you that. She described his struggle. He's struggling for his life, and she continues to pull that chain, demonstrating her intent to kill Shad Therian. And we know that because we see that in the physical evidence. We see the marks on Shad's tongue. We see the damage to his neck. She described to you what she did with his body after she killed Shad. And we know that it's true because the body parts were exactly where she told you they were. Detectives are finding everything she says on scene, and you saw it with your own eyes, that just what she told you is exactly where those things were located in that residence. She wasn't cloudy. She wasn't unclear. She wasn't hopped up on drugs. She knew where to find the drugs. She knew where they'd find the pipe. She knew where they'd find the chains. She knew where they'd find the knives. She knew the name of the bag where the body parts were going to be located. She could tell you that she put the organs in plastic bags. She could tell you that she cleaned up with Clorox wipes and she put them in the bags as well. She could tell you that his lower extremities were in the car. This is the most specific confession anyone could ask for, and it is corroborated in detail by the work of the Green Bay Police Department. This is bizarre. This is strange. This is unnatural, but it is in no way unclear. We know exactly what happened. We know exactly what Taylor intended to happen for all three of these offenses. She engaged in intentional conduct in each of these acts. You are asked to look at each of the six elements, and there are only the six elements that Attorney Saunders described to you. That as to count one, she did cause Shad's death. There is no doubt she had the mental purpose to do that. And that she knew that her conduct was practically certain to cause it. She described to you how she visualized him struggling, blood coming out of his mouth, but she did not stop. He's turning purple, but she did not stop. He's coughing up blood. He's pissing himself, in her words, but she did not stop. This was a deliberate choice on her part to kill Shad Therian, and she knew that her actions were going to cause that. And in fact, she was asked whether or not she liked it, and she confirmed that she liked it. She was asked whether she was sexually aroused by killing him, and she said she was. Her mental purpose was clear. As to the mutilating the corpse, again, there's no doubt that she intentionally did that. She described the detail. She described her frustration as she's mutilating this corpse, and she described her purpose in doing so. How else am I going to get the body out of the house? How else am I going to get away with this if I don't cut this body up? And she didn't just cut it up and leave it there. She cut it up, she packaged it, she cleaned up after herself. Her purpose in dismembering Shad was clear. She wanted to attempt to get away with this crime. A crime that she intentionally committed. A crime that was not accidental, that was not a surprise to her. That she didn't wake up from this nightmare and then call the police and call Shad's mom. No, she made the second deliberate choice. After deliberately choosing to kill him, she deliberately chooses to dismember him and attempt to cover up her crimes. And likewise, the sexual assault is equally clear. There's no doubt that she had sexual intercourse. And for counsel to say that we can't merely accept the word of the defendant You're asked routinely in sexual assault cases, juries are asked routinely to take the word of a crime victim with no physical evidence. We don't have to take the word of the crime victim. We have the word of the defendant who confesses to this crime and tells you exactly what she did, again, with specificity, and tells you, you know what, I did this and I did it with that dildo. And here's where you can find the dildo. It's in the wall, it's in the box, I put it away. And what happened? They found it in the box, put away exactly where she described that it would be. And she clearly was sexually aroused by this whole incident, and she described that to you herself. So clearly it follows, it makes sense, it's logical, it is reasonable that she did exactly what she told you she did. There is absolutely no reasonable hypothesis consistent with her innocence. The only hypothesis, the only choice that you have before you here today is to find Taylor Shabusiness guilty of each and every count for which she is charged. All of those elements have been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and I ask that you return a verdict of guilty. Thank you.
Now, members of the jury, the duties of counsel in the court have been performed. The case has been argued by counsel. The court has instructed you regarding the rules of law which should govern you in your deliberations. The time has now come when the great burden of reaching a just, fair, and conscientious decision of this case is to be thrown wholly upon you, the jurors, selected for this important duty. You will not be swayed by sympathy, prejudice, or passion. You will be very careful and deliberate in weighing the evidence. I charge you to keep your duty steadfastly in mind and, as upright citizens, to render a just and true verdict. You are to decide only whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty of the offenses charged. Any consequences of your verdict are matters for the court alone to decide and must not affect your deliberations. The following six forms of verdict will be submitted to you concerning the charges against the defendant, Taylor Shabusiness. One reading, we the jury find the defendant, Taylor Shabusiness, guilty of first-degree intentional homicide as charged in count one of the information. Another reading, we the jury find the defendant, Taylor Shabusiness, not guilty of first-degree intentional homicide as charged in count one of the information. Another reading, we the jury find the defendant, Taylor Shabusiness, guilty of mutilating a corpse as charged in count two of the information. Another reading, we the jury find the defendant, Taylor Shabusiness, not guilty of mutilating a corpse as charged in count two of the information. Another reading, we the jury find the defendant, Taylor Shabusiness, guilty of third degree sexual assault as charged in count three of the information. Another reading, we the jury find the defendant, Taylor Shabusiness, not guilty of third degree sexual assault as charged in count three of the information. It is for you to determine whether the defendant is guilty or not guilty of each of the offenses charged. You must make a finding as to each count of the information. Each count charges a separate crime, and you must consider each one separately. Your verdict for the crime charged in one count must not affect your verdict on any other count. This is a criminal, not a civil case. Therefore, before the jury may return a verdict which may legally be received, the verdict must be reached unanimously. In a criminal case, all 12 jurors must agree in order to arrive at a verdict. When you retire to the jury room, select one of your members to preside over your deliberations. The presiding juror's vote is entitled to no greater weight than the vote of any other juror. If you need to communicate with the court while you are deliberating, send a note through the bailiff signed by the presiding juror. To have a complete record of this trial, it is important that you communicate with the court only by a written note. If you have a question, the court will talk with the attorneys before answering it, so it may take some time. You should continue your deliberations while you wait for an answer. The court will answer any questions in writing or orally here in open court. When you have agreed upon your verdict, have it signed and dated by the person you have selected to preside. After you have reached a verdict, the presiding juror will notify the bailiff that a verdict has been reached. Everyone will return to the courtroom. The verdict will be read into the record in open court, and the court may ask each of you if you agree with this verdict. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is the unfortunate time, because now is the time when we select the alternate jurors. Let me tell you what the process is going to be. The computer has selected four of you. We're going to read those names here shortly. If your name is read, I'm going to ask that you simply stand up and go have a seat in that first pew right there, because I'm going to want to address you, first pew right here, because it's open. And I'm going to address you after the other jurors have been excused. The remaining 12 jurors are going to participate in the deliberation process, and you will accompany the bailiffs to the jury room. If you're selected as an alternate, your participation in the case at this point will be concluded. I will make sure, however, that you are addressed by a bailiff who will assist you in retrieving any items that you may have in the jury room. So at this time, then, I'm going to ask that the clerk read the names of the four jurors that have been selected by the computer randomly.
Nicholas Rozek. You will, to the utmost of your ability, keep all jurors sworn on this trial in some private and convenient place, subject to the direction of the court, until they have agreed on their verdict or are discharged by the court, and that you will not, before they render their verdict, communicate to any person the state of their deliberations or the verdict they have agreed upon, so help you God.
I do.
Thank you.
All rise for the jury. Might be seated. I want to first address Mr. Rozek, Mr. Lynette, Mr. Beerhals, and Ms. Schrader. I want to thank you very much for your service on this case. You've all paid careful attention. I've been able to observe all of you throughout the trial, and I really appreciate that, and so do all the parties. At this time, your service in this case is completed. Many jurors ask if they're allowed to discuss the case with others at the conclusion of their service. Because your role in this case is over, you are not prohibited from discussing the case with anyone. However, you should know that you do not have to discuss the case with anyone or answer any questions about it from anyone other than from the court. This includes the parties, the lawyers, the media, or anyone else. If you do decide to discuss this case with anyone, I would suggest that you treat any discussion with a degree of solemnity such that whatever you do say, you would be willing to say in the presence of your fellow jurors or under oath here in open court in the presence of the parties. Finally, should any of you have any questions before you leave today, please let the bailiff know before you leave. And you can confer with me at any time before answering any questions asked by anyone if you choose. The bailiff is standing right back there. I'm just going to ask you to get up then and accompany her out that door, and if there's anything that you need to retrieve. But again, thank you for your service. Anything to take up before we recess, Mr. Saunders?
No.
Mr. Frelick?
Not at this time.
Very good. Then we are in recess. I'd ask the parties to remain very close here to the courtroom for at least 30 minutes. Oftentimes, if questions come in, they come in early. After that, if you just simply leave a cell phone number where we can reach you, then you're free to depart. But I'd still ask you to remain close to the courthouse. But at this time, then, we are in recess.
Thank you.
You're listening to True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast continuous coverage of the trial of Taylor Shabusiness, Nightmare in Wisconsin.
Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage.
More raw trial audio next.